the French say, Vachon. Listen to Brown briefly. We're Less Is More, More or Less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hello again, friends, coming to you live from Vachon Island, Washington. This is a Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show radiating from the beehive of creativity, civic engagement, and cultural awareness known formerly as the Gene Bosch Voice of Vachon Broadcast Studio. In the bustling and pervasive heart of our pastoral island community, that was the voice of our late founder, Brian Brown. Together, we the Briefly strive to keep Brian's brilliant flame alive by bringing you weekly episodes of intelligent discussion of the current events laced with humor and empathy, always guided by Brian's mantra, less is more, more or less. Our Briefly panel includes Control Board Magician, Vachon Airport Commissioner, partially reformed, Lexan, and the longest serving Briefly is
straight. Again, that's not quite right. That's half right.
Let's first check in with Briefly's and our guests about how things are going. So, great. Maybe you could get us started.
I just had a wonderful past week. I hit on two of the highlights. One was, again, across the street here, a little bit down from our downtown or uptown studio at the station. I listened to Croker, the group play. I don't know if it was Friday night. Yeah, last Friday night. Wonderful venue. Saturday, there were five of us that ventured overseas to Seattle and to go to the World of Whiskey at the Rainier Club. That was imbibed, of course. Well, maybe what it was. There were, I don't know, 40 different distilleries represented there. They were giving tastes of both. And then they had multiple bottles of, of American bourbon and rye and Scotch whiskey. It was quite evening. I had done something like that when Susan McCollum had her 16th birthday. I kind of appreciated this. I had a Scotch tour of Scotland, John Daly. And we started in the low ones, and everybody got a little taste of it, and there must have been 20 to 25 different scotches.
Wow.
And it's just amazing how different they are.
It's just amazing. What a treat.
My only experience with real experience with scotch was my wife and my dad got out of the army in Germany, as I did.
Excited,
right? I was ready to go. I was sitting there in my underwear.
person decides that it's learned, that it wants to trigger their learned kind of like come out of it, like avoid that associated with something else later. Or as a 10-year old, you met from another last person. And what else has it been up to this week?
We had our first harvest of the oysters that we planted in May, which is very exciting. The Pacific sterile triploid oysters are ready to eat. They're about sugar size. And we scrambled some up with eggs for breakfast.
Awesome. Something for those of you in attendance, you can take some home as quartermaster samples.
We love the oysters.
All right, so Rocky, that was your voice jumping in, and that's so how's your week going?
What's great? You know what? The highlights is actually Jen Bruce and I in the Quartermaster Harbor on Saturday and tour around our boat and took a look at all the historic sites in our Quartermaster Harbor. So thanks, Bruce, for the amazing thought-provoking tour. And then dropped it off by hauling my boat out from the water, hauling it out from water for the season. And that's it all off. So there's a salmon season is officially over.
As a matter of fact, I was hailed from the beach as you went by. I was like, Kevin, Kevin, I want to say something. I'm like, who are they? So I was able to go to his memorial service with, he was honored at the Environmental Society meeting by Zoom. And it's just sort of interesting, you know, that, you know, halfway around the world, you know, I get to see his kids, his family, his kids, which I, you know, I've known for 20 years, so I've watched his kids grow up. It's that kind of thing. So it was just that, you know, despite the ubiquity of screens, there are times when it's just wonderful to be able to be. Itself is kind of a basically an aggressive war dance, if you will, or sort of like that. It's sort of a challenge, that sort of thing. But they have a biannual Hapahaka contest where tribal groups from all over the country compete. And I mean, they are just spectacular. And it's song, it's dance, it's hakas, it's a whole combination of things. Of course, if you've ever seen the All Blacks, they start, the All Blacks is a national rugby team for New Zealand. They start every game with a haka. You understand? It is impressive. It's a lot of I'm not sure I want to play these guys. Have you been in New Zealand? I have no. Just like, you gotta go. I don't know where you're about to go. So that was good. And then I had a chance yesterday to go through the Yantikara art exhibit. Larson to the curators of it. And it's a fascinating sort of look at resistance art, if you will, Kevin. You know, so like how do artists sort of respond to these outrages that we're seeing coming on a daily basis almost? And it's worth a visit. I think it's up till next Tuesday or next Wednesday, something like that. But well worth a visit. And then, of course, football. Huskies won, the Seahawks won. Season 2. It's going to be
as you get into your more complex life, you're picking up one and then another and then another. And in the course of this dance, he started out with just a few, and then he was wearing many, many, many. And I thought, wow, I really feel that metaphor. And I hadn't heard that explanation before about the dance. I really appreciate it. It related to me even more.
So it's not saying the last third of your life you try to divest yourself. Thing I mentioned for Tuesday, November 25th. Today is Blase Day. Not about Blase Day, but that spoiler alert that I wanted to mention on here today. On this day in 1783, Britain evacuated New York City, their last outpost in the United States.
For many years, and a friend enlisted us into her team to write the 2024 Passport to Pain. And after that, we just felt so cool to the island that we moved there a couple months later, and I think this week marks our 1 year anniversary of moving here.
Yes, it does.
So, Passport to Pain did not deter you and inspire you. Aside from that, what do you do day to day? And secondly, why did you join the board of the community council? Did you have a particular interest that you wanted to further?
Well, we moved a year ago to a house with a strong DIY tradition, and so day to day, I'm mostly painting, gluing, and stapling the house. Before we moved here, I worked in medical systems leading multidisciplinary teams on projects to improve patient care. And I feel really motivated to apply that skill set to food in our community. resources. So this is part of that mission.
Is that the reason why you got involved with the community council, or do you just have a sense of public service?
I want to apply the quality improvement skills to the community, so that it's not for the purpose of making profit, but for the purpose of human well-being.
How long have you been on the board?
6 months.
6 months? What do you think of the Community Council General?
Well, I think it's a great way to bring together people with a bunch of different interest areas, because everybody who's representing their own nonprofit kind of has their own angle. And I feel like the Community Council is able to bridge across all of those areas. And it has as much energy and as much power as people believe that it has. And it has as much depth as the volunteers that participate. So it's very much a direct democracy.
And that's great. You would know a bit about this, but the history of the Community Council goes back to the James Hall Plan of the 1960s. And so the reason I call the Community Community Alliance or Community Assembly, another story. At the Land Trust on First Friday about Bajon streams and stream restoration on Bajon Island. And so tell us a little bit about your background. You've been doing stream restoration for a while and all over Western Washington and other places. And what do you see the potentials and the issues here on Bajon?
Yes, please. Well, I've been doing stream restoration for my third decade now. And I've worked on all levels from working with the hand crews, actually trying to figure out what sticks and groups we call it. And where we have educational outreach and community groups just trying to do work on the local streams, all the way to some very, very large, $20 million estuary restoration projects in Hawaii, where we're moving 200,000 yards in about 2 months or two to 2 months in season. So I've worked at all scales. We're in Washington, Hawaii, and I'm a boots on the ground guy. I want to be out there to see it built, and then I do a design work that sure it sets. Right? So it takes time in the field. So I travel a lot, I go where the water is. And something that really struck me when we moved here to Bajon is how rich the streams are in potential. I've worked in some terribly beat up systems, in intersection of Mount Judd, and it just replaces it beauty. There's 30 years where the land trust has been securing land around it to protect them and to get the vegetation going again. The water is cold and clear. That combination of having land and vegetation and open water is super rare and precious. But particularly in the Puget Sound, most of our streams and rivers are filled by snowmelt. We're not. The water here comes out of the aquifer. It comes out cold, it comes out clean. And that's the foundation of a great stream system. So what I see in Gashan that's really unique is this, it's going to be some of the most straightforward restoration to increase the productivity. Really what's been happening is, decades of industrialization and manipulation of the land has simplified the landscape and dredging and ditching. And it's actually going to be pretty straightforward to put this system back together to maximize water storage, wetlands habitat, fish habitat. It's actually relative to everything else we've worked on. This is some of the most straightforward projects out there.
Let me follow up with that. There's two major streams on that shore, Shingle Mill and Jeb Creek. But how many other streams are potentially salmon streams, and how many streams could be restored? What's the potential?
What's the potential, Bruce? I have to turn that back to you. The work that you and Bruce Marshall did to look at the historic abundance of streams was really unparalleled. If you look at that 1754 graphic, you see how this island supported 12,000 people for thousands of years. With the richness of the streams, and the cod, and the herring, and the smelt, and the salmon, and the bottom fish, the flatfish, the shellfish, you laid that out so clearly. It's been an inspiration for me. And now as I look through that lens, I see that we still have the echoes of that past abundance. The species are mostly still here. They're still hanging on. We can reach out and give them a hand. When we look to the future, we should look in the rearview mirror and look at the work you did. That shows us what incredible abundance we have in terms of fisheries that we can have again.
I've got to ask one quick question. It's a quick question to ask. It has to do with the actual function of stream restoration. I remember I used to work with a contractor, a representative, and he had made a mistake when he was working on a stream and took out I don't know how many thousands of fingerlings by accident by moving subsoil into the stream or the wrong. You have to be careful when you're in the stream restoration. You could be alarmed too, can't you, if you're not careful?
Depending on how you approach it, you can do a light sensor every touch, and it's all dependent on what's happening for the stream and the location. And in some cases, a heavy touch is appropriate. You move buildings out of the way, move roads out of the way, move sewer lines out of the way. You need to give the streams space to breathe. Think about when you breathe, your lungs expand, and they take in more space, but to really breathe, you open up. And when a stream needs to breathe, it also needs to open up and have the room to move across the landscape. So sometimes we need to move human-built impediments out of the way to let the streams breathe. When it rains and the rains come down, the streams need to breathe in and soak up all that water so that they can clean it in the wetlands so you can get it to infiltrate to recharge our aquifer. If a stream doesn't have room to breathe in all that water, then it roars out like a fire hose. We've lost that great opportunity. Right? It runs out fast and dirty, takes the landscape with it, dumps out the bay. We've lost that chance. So that's what we really have to look at here, is how do we allow the streams to breathe in all the water we get from these rains, hold it, clean it, purify it, cool it down, and release it slowly into the system. That will help bring back abundance of the fish and wildlife and the somnolence and the amphibians. Right? All of these life forms need that water just as much as we do.
Stumps and things like that. But what the heck are we doing in some
science fiction novel. There's no formula. People have tried that. What you really have to do is enter the landscape with an open heart and an open mind and to listen and to hear what the water is telling you, what the land is telling you. You have to walk a lot of streams to have seen what really great habitat looks like and to have a sense of the color reference condition. And you can find, if you know of a stream, you can either find a little microcosm of goodness in the stream you're going to work on. You go, oh, that's great. It's full of fish. It's got wetlands with it. It's abundant. Right? So sometimes you can find a reference location or a reach that you just say, this is really great. Can I duplicate it? And try to duplicate it. Sometimes you look elsewhere. Just say areas that were preserved or protected. Sometimes, and I love what Bruce has done, is we look to the past, we find historical images, we find the stories of the people that were here before we cut down and bulldozed and straightened and slashed down. And we look at those reference images and we try to understand what it's telling us. So really the open heart is to listen deeply. And the open mind is to accept input from a whole variety of sources. And yes, science is super important. Measurements and, you know, photographs and time series, data collection is super important. I can't understand that, but we have to have the humility to hear what that means for the landscape.
Okay, sticking with you, my other input is that I'm an airport commissioner, and the National Airport is one of those sets that they have, and we have a considerable
stumps in the lower reach. They look great. And we have some of the best habitat that exists in Chimino Creek right now. And we can look at that, and I have looked at that, and says, how is this working? What was done? How is that really working well? How could we build upon that? What, as an experiment, how do we build upon that to get great habitat out of this exact spot? So in regards to water quality, I have not been collecting water quality data. I would turn to the National Nature Center, and they have been true stewards of the land. They've been collecting data for decades on water quality, on species abundance, through the BIDI process, looking at the macroinvertebrates. And when you study the macroinvertebrates, that is an indicator of the collective impact of chemicals and water quality and temperature over time. So you can either measure it directly, which is hard to do, like a spill, right? It's hard to get out there and grab that sample. But you can see the macroinvertebrates. And looking at that profile of which organisms exist, maybe an indicator of what the long-term trends of the system are. And I know that the Nature Center has gathered a lot of that data, and we're looking forward to learning from them what they have learned over being stewards of these waters for decades.
Yeah, we're very involved in service water management. It's a huge thing with the report, and every 10, 19 acres.
basic approaches that are actually really well established to help mitigate that. And so that it's, you're holding it on the site, and so it really slowly, or you don't want it to spread out before it gets to the most connected parts of the stream. So there are things you can do.
So it's like an incubator for the stuff that the salmon eat and the whales eat the salmon. So it's like a, it's a really ecological rich area, and being divided like this, it's the infill is drying out the saltwater marsh, and it's limiting the travel of the water across, which was historically there.
Yeah, we have to think about Cormaster Harbor in terms of what it used to be. Serve. And you know, if we were to reopen Portage, what environmental benefit, what water quality benefit would it be? And we think that, you know, I think most people believe that it would have some benefit, but we have to recognize there's a larger legacy of historic pollution in Cormaster Harbor that needs to be addressed. If we're really going to solve water quality issues, we have to acknowledge that over the last 100 years or so, there were multiple sawmills, there was a fuel dock, there's boat yards, there were fisheries, a pod cannery there, right? So for decades, people were just using it as a garbage dump for fish waste, wood waste, spills of fuel, and so all of that falls down and goes up in the sediment. The study done at Kent in 2014 very clearly identifies that one of the largest sources of nitrogen in Cormaster Harbor is the sediment. And they didn't get so far as to figure out like what's down there, what we do about it, but they flagged it. We talk a lot about septic systems. Septic systems are really important to control. Kent has actually been doing a really good job. We can see the decline in septic input over time. And right now, the bottom sediments are contributing 50 times the nutrient load of Cormaster Harbor than septic systems are. So if we want to get serious about cleaning up Cormaster Harbor, we have to say, what is in the bottom of this harbor that is releasing hundreds of pounds of nitrogen per day? Because what happens is you have this nitrogen cycling that happens. It comes from the sediments. It basically mobilizes as an aqueous solution. Algae and phytoplankton take that up. It clouds the which then sets a cycle of more algae growing in the system, right? And then in the fall, those algae begin to die. They fall to the bottom. As they die, they take up oxygen. It takes the oxygen down to like 2 milligrams per liter. Fish can't live below like 4 or 5 milligrams. When salmon kick off, they won't exist at anything below 5. So every fall, the water quality drops, the pH drops to nothing. It just dies. It's an anoxic zone in the bottom, so fish can't live, crabs can't live. And then, come the spring, warms up again. You know, those nitrogen come back out of sediment, back into solution. So it cycles. It's a forever cycle. So we have to figure out how to interrupt that cycle of nitrogen. And we have ideas, you know, but we have, that's where we have to start. That nitrogen cycling is the root of the problem.
So that's going to affect the terms of fishery.
Any juvenile fish that come out of Jet Creek, they're going to have to try to live in the bay. Right? And as the adults are coming back, getting ready to migrate, they have to enter that right about in the fall, right when the anoxic conditions are the worst, which means they have to hop to the top to get into oxygen. Well, then they're more likely to be preyed upon by seals, right? They're hunting in the upper water column. They can no longer hang on the bottom and hide in the structure because there's no oxygen.
And it's not much of a place to hide. In 6 months, and they take up nitrogen and they filter water. So one adult oyster can filter 50 gallons of water a day, and an adult mussel
50 gallons
a day. And a mussel can filter 10 to 20 gallons a day. So if we had a million oysters in Inner Quartermaster Harbor, it would filter all of that water in 2 months. We grew about 5,000 since May. And if we multiply that by 5 times, we could get them all home from Shelton in one carload. There would be about 25,000 oysters. They would all fit on a property at about zero tide. And if 40 more groups of people did that, we would be in a million.
Wow.
Yeah.
40 carloads of oysters.
So 6 months old, they were shooters at this point. But they're growing about twice as fast as we had expected them to, based on, you know, our expectations and research, which says that the harbor has an abundant supply of food. It's warm enough that it really accelerates their growth. We've checked with, you know, with the State Department of Health in regards to safety, and they've assured us that there's regular monitoring all through Quartermaster Harbor, so you can use the Shellfish Paralytic Safety, Paralytic Shellfish app. And it does work for Quartermaster Harbor, even though the northern part of the harbor is unclassified, so they're sampling that all the time. So that's good to know, because we always have to be mindful of health of shellfish. So they do grow on the bottom, but you can also suspend them in bags. You can suspend them in containers off of the bed. So if you have a buoy, for instance, you can hang them off a buoy. We put ours in two textile bags and lay them on the tide lines at about zero. That way they're underwater most of the time and they get the fastest growth out of them. They will grow down to about 35 feet below water. So they're very adaptable. And we're talking about simple way to think about it is like, if you want to do something good for yourself, that's good for the environment, do a 50-50 plan. Do a Taylor shellfish, get half of the oysters that are Olympias. Those are a wild native that are spawning. Like, they're having trouble getting established in Quartermaster, though we have found a few native olies here. And the shell middens, the archaeological studies show that olies were part of the native diet. There's middens a meter and a half high by Jump Creek, so they've been here historically. They're still out there, but their populations are low. So if we all went out and said, okay, half of our buy is going to be Olympias, and we set them aside, go and eat them so they can't be eaten by fish and birds, and then we scatter them and let them get started on their own. The other half could be a triploid, which is a sterile oyster that grows super fast, as we brought today, Pacific oyster. So then you eat the half that's the sterile oyster that grows really fast, and you put back the half that's the native oyster and help them get reestablished in Quartermaster Harbor. So that's a way you can, you know, satisfy the goodness of the world and yourself.
Do you have anything else? I'm going to jump off of what individual people can do to what the county or government agencies, how can they help in this, in the work that you do?
Well, you know, the county, the governments have a really important role here. So, first off, you know, the county has been buying land from willing landowners and taking out bulkheads. Renaturalizing the shoreline, about half of the island is rock, bulkhead, right, which the whole Puget Sound on average is about 26%. So we have about twice as many bulkheads per length of it. We have 50 miles of shoreline than the rest of Puget Sound. So that's something the county is doing actively, and they're going to continue to do that. You know, I think the biggest thing that they could do is they could fund a study of the bottom sediments and see what is down there. Should be done about it and take the lead. That's a big, expensive, and really thought-provoking study. That you take this contamination, how do we handle this in a sustainable way? But look, both the traditional ways of handling this as well as the innovative and nature-based solutions that are really emerging in the scientific front, like growing oysters. The East Coast is decades ahead of us on oyster restoration. Jim and I were just back in Connecticut last week, and Jim, you should share what you saw there.
At a conference, yeah, so the Atlantic coast is much more subject to large storms and hurricanes than we are over here. And they've mitigated they found that the bulkheads aren't very effective in holding very large storm waves off. So what they've done instead is added a berm and a saltwater marsh after their bulkhead to help slow down the waves as they're coming into the land. And it just happens that those berms, which they usually build with oyster reefs, are also really good at unfiltering water because they have had a lot of pollution and industry on the East Coast. So after having rivers catch on fire, they've been probably in a worse situation than we have been regarding the pollution, and they've had to be much more aggressive at finding ways of mitigating that pollution. And oysters are their go-to species. Mussels are really good, too.
And what could the government do, you know, really to move this into a scale where we could make a difference? We could look at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. For 40 years, they've been working to put billions of oysters out, and they've looked both at cleaning up the pollution coming in from the streams, but also restoring these massive oyster reefs that were endemic to that area. We used to have oysters here. They were just kind of collected by the first settlers. The first white settlers, an easy, cheap source of protein. These were replenished. So we depleted too far for them to naturally recover. But in the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, they spent 40 years really perfecting the techniques for oyster restoration, the techniques for ecosystem recovery. We can learn from them. But what the government could do is to say, you know what, we acknowledge that there's value in a sizzle initiative, and we're going to give you guys some funds to, you know, try the pilot programs that you want to fund some of the larger planning efforts that could bring our community together to say, what do we want to do right here to be stewards of this land as a community? Not a government-driven program, but a citizen-led program that we can utilize some of the taxpayer money we're contributing and use some of that to implement some of these ideas, both in the planning process and actual demonstration and full-scale implementation to clean up water quality, clean up programs and harbor, but it's driven by us, the citizens of the island.
Thank you.
this is how exciting stuff came about, and I think the potential's there. Another sort of element of it is access. You know, I mean, for you living on the harbor, you can place yourself in front of your house where somebody doesn't live on the harbor or doesn't have the waterfront. How do they get engaged with that process? And then, you know, what's their benefit in getting the harbor cleaned up? Because there's very little public access to the harbor. So how do we sort of bridge that?
Stories that I've heard about the dock in Trent Harbor and how culturally that important that is to people and how they would love to have the funds to rebuild it. And I hear it when I hear people asking frequently about Portage and let's open up Portage. I think, well, opening up Portage also, I think, should be paired with people having access to the water in that same space. And if we're going to build heavy equipment, bring in heavy equipment to be able to do a big project, let's also include in that project how people are going to interface with the water. So I 100% agree with you. And this land that King County has been buying up along the shoreline is owned by the residents of King County as a park. I think there are 12,000 of us here on Vashon, and there are 2.3 million people in King County. And so getting the attention of the people who are staff at King County is possible, but we need to be really organized and pointed in what our requests are. So I believe that through citizen action and conversations, we can talk about this land that's already owned by us as the people and figure out how to, like, what do people want? What does access mean to people? And what, let's organize our request.
The president of the community council many years ago, there was a study done about how difficult it is to open up the Portage because of the shallowness and how far it goes and the dredging that would have to be done constantly if you kept a road on top to open up the water flow. It would constantly be, and if you put in huge, you know, pipe, what we call it, culverts, they would have to, if they fill up the silt over and over and over again, there'd be a lot of work to keep those clear. Do you know anything about that?
Well, there's been a lot of advancements in the science and the engineering, coastal engineering, coastal design in the last decade and a half in particular.
I was wondering about that.
Our computational models are far more powerful now than three-dimensional hydraulic models and sediment transport models. Just the whole science has really moved forward, as well as our understanding of our own limitations. Again, humility. When we try to contain nature in a pipe, it's probably a recipe for disaster. So, when we look at the old photographs and read the stories, Portage was intermittently connected at high tide system that would periodically shoal shut with sand and then it would open again. And so we have to really, in our humility, we have to look at the record, the archaeological record, the geological record, and understand, set reasonable expectations. We're not going to go in and dredge it regularly, but what would be the configuration that would allow nature to reconnect between Tramp and Quartermaster Harbor in a way that restores the ecological connectivity and the integrity that it had historically, but fits a modern lifestyle. It would take some thought and some conversation and some science and engineering. But we have to set reasonable expectations for what is that going to provide. And even if, recognize it, even restoring that tidal wetland, the saltwater marsh, would be an enormous benefit for the species that migrate through that corridor. And the species develop here in abundance with those two connected. It seems that if we're searching for abundance, maybe that's an important consideration. So we need to look at that and be thoughtful about it.
Oyster reefs over time would create a space that fish can hide in. There is an ecological benefit to the saltwater marsh and the connection between the two bodies of water that the oysters can't provide for us. So I guess I see them as kind of different things. But I think that if I had a dime for all of the people who asked about opening Portage, you know, I could put that point on to grow oysters. And, you know, even if you don't live on the water, go grab your friend who does, or let's build a coalition to, you know, put lists of names together. Here's a bunch of property owners, and here's a bunch of people who want to grow oysters, and just pair them up and make friends. And, you know, it's like 30 cents an oyster, as opposed to $3 an oyster if you buy it at the grocery store, like if you just let it grow for free for 6 months. So I think that the whole community could win if we got together and played with this.
Off the land around us. And this land sustained people for thousands of years. And it's shellfish, and it's fish, and it's forests. I'm a hunter, I'm a fisherman. We think of these things.
Which I'm talking about, the subject that we've been discussing here is the ecological health and access for Quartermaster Portage and Trent Harbor. And I think that you've done a fantastic job of explaining why all three of those aspects, right? Harbor, Portage, all are within consideration, right? Because they all can play a role in this evolution of where we are now to what could be the art of the possible, right? In terms of sustainability, food resources, clean, healthy water, as well as the fisheries that it supports. So I think that I know that, you know, the Tramp Harbor Dock that you mentioned earlier, there has been passionate discussion about the Tramp Harbor Dock. I'm sure that you're aware of some of those conversations and some of the people who've invested their time and energy in that topic alone. So you mentioned community, getting people together. What are your plans for that? How does that look like for you moving forward to bring all of those diverse opinions around this topic we've been discussing today?
Well, speaking on behalf of the council is interested in doing public outreach and having conversations with people about this topic. If you go to the council website, v-mcc.org, under news, there's a posting that gives a little bit of information about this conversation. A reference list, and also has my email address, and I would encourage anybody interested in joining a coalition to reach out to me so that we can get together and figure out what the next steps are. And our ability to move this and to create a movement depends on volunteer efforts and or making a pitch to some funding agencies to fund some people to do this as their job.
Yeah, it seems like the Canadian Council is historically in a great position to do that because of the relationships with King County, the fact that, you know, that local instantiation of democracy here on the island is the one democratic element we have, and it's critical to reach out to King County's number of things we talked about. What could the county do? And so you envision that those are all part of the conversation that we bring forward through working with the council.
Absolutely. And what we learned at this conference in Connecticut was that nonprofit organizations do a better job of the citizen conversations than the government.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you again, of course, for showing up and bringing all of this tremendous information to the Brown Briefly and our listeners. Next week is great to be hosting the show. We're talking about the next week. Well, we've got our music producer, singer-songwriter, Martin Perrier, also Bowie Rex. AKA Bowie Rex, he's going to be joining us next week.